So I like this little quote. The point I want to make is that we don't deal with reality as mathematicians and engineers. By and large, what we deal with is models. Eventually, we have to go and build something in reality, but even then, you never really, you know, you don't model every atom that's going on. You don't understand every atom that's happening in a bridge or some sort of circuit. What you understand is some sort of analogy, some model for what's going on there. This is particularly true for signals, particularly these days. I talked about real signals being continuous in the last lecture, but real signals, the real signals that we deal with are typically not continuous. They're discrete functions. They work in discrete time, they have discrete values. And this arises because computers these days are so powerful and so useful for doing so many of the tasks that we generally take on, that we use them almost ubiquitously. But computers operate in the digital domain. They operate with digital data where we represent numbers by ones and zeros. So they can't represent a continuous number, at least not with any great degree of ease. Moore's law in particular has been one of the forces, the driving forces behind this. So Moore's law is this best expressed by this big graph. And what it says is the power of computers has roughly doubled every 18 months. Actually, you can argue a bit about the period that it takes for that doubling. The important thing is it's exponential. You can see it on this graph. This is plotting the transistor counts for the Intel chips over the last couple of decades, starting from the 8088, the 4044, coming up to relatively close to the present. And you can see that when I plot it with a log y-axis, notice this is a log scale on the y-axis, it's approximated by a straight line. That corresponds to exponential growth, doubling every period of a few years. What does that mean? Well, we talk about DSP. DSP stands for digital signal processing. What it means is that DSP chips as well, they follow a similar curve. DSP chips have this exponential increase in power. What that means is that if you want to design some sort of new device, it's even if it's not practical today, within a few years it's very likely to be practical. Say you need 10 times as much processing power on your chip as you can buy today. Well, you only have to wait a few years before you get that factor of 10 increase. So things that you can't imagine today are likely to be cheap and easy tomorrow. The biggest, most obvious example of this to me is the CD player. CD players came out in the, say, 80s. And when they came out, they were hugely expensive. There weren't that many CDs you could buy for them. And they were, you know, audiophile gear. They were things for people who were really into audio. You know, they were a couple thousand bucks for a CD player. Now you can go and buy a CD player for 50 bucks. Why is that? Well, physically, a CD player is just the thing which spins this little CD, a little laser, and a bunch of DSP stuff. It takes the output of that laser and converts it into audio. Now, the physical part, the thing that spins the disc, those things have a minimum cost. They're like a fixed cost because the mechanics of that doesn't follow Moore's law. But they have reduced because the number of CD players being made today is much higher. The lasers are now done using silicon. The electronics, the audio part of it is all digital. And so that part has become a minuscule part of the cost. In fact, if you looked at a CD player today, probably the electrical components of it, the most expensive thing is probably the circuit board and the capacitors and soldering it all together. Not the actual smart bit of it, not the DSP chip. The DSP chip, I have no idea what it costs. It probably costs a few cents out of your CD player. And yet that's where all of the smart part of the CD player comes, the digital technology. This is a really incredible revolution in terms of the sorts of consumer devices people can get. and the sorts of high-end devices we can build, things like radars and so on. So Moore's Law has been this really huge driver of digital signal processing. And these days, I barely know anything about analog signal processing. Most people who go out from signal processing, they're going to be using digital signal processing, and the first thing you want to do is take whatever continuous signal you have and turn it into a digital signal. So this lecture is about two things. Firstly, it's about how you do that. It's about how you take your real-time continuous signal and you turn it into something digital that you can work with in the digital domain. And then it's about how we take our Fourier transform and we turn that into a discrete transform that we can use on these discrete signals. There's a couple of kind of amusing laws that go along with here. Gates' law, the speed of software halves every 18 months. There's a joke that no matter how fast people make computers, Microsoft will manage to make software that runs slowly on it. The nice thing about DSP chips is that we don't run Windows on DSP chips. We typically run very small lightweight OSs that don't have a lot of features but run very, very efficiently. So these generally make nice progress alongside your hardware. On the other hand, Parkinson's law of data expands to fill the available storage. This law goes back a long way. This goes back to when people had floppy disks that could store 400K on them, and it didn't seem to matter how many of them you bought, you would always fill them up. Today you can get one hard drive that will store 750 gigabytes of data on it, and it still doesn't seem to be that hard to fill one of those guys up. This is doubly true of digital signal processing. The more storage we get, the more we want to use. And the faster your DSP chips get, the faster they can sample, the more data you will collect more quickly. The cheaper those DSP chips become, the more ubiquitous they become, the more data you're going to collect. Today we're at the point where you can collect terabytes of data without a hell of a lot of problems. And this can be a real issue, particularly when you consider you've got your DSP chip, which is fast, you've got your disk, which is pretty big and might be able to store the data, but disks quite often are very slow. So getting the data from the DSP chip onto the disk can sometimes be the bottleneck. So there are a whole bunch of issues around this. I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time dealing with them. What I want to talk about is the fundamental issues with taking your continuous signal and turning it into a digital signal. These are the really fundamental things, the things you can't get away from in some form or other. The three things that I want to concentrate on are the fact that real signals are finite, that is, they have a start and a stop. The Fourier transform assumes your signal is infinite in duration. This has implications. We'll talk about some of them. Real data has discrete time. That means it comes in samples. You have a click here, you have a sample here, a sample here. You don't have a continuous signal. You don't have a continuous function. And real signals are discrete valued. They're digital. They have discrete sets of values. We sometimes become a bit blasé about this. For instance, you use floating point numbers a lot probably on your computer, and you probably typically assume that a floating point number can take any value you like. It can't. There are fixed possible values it can take. Your double precision floating point probably takes 64 bits to store. In DSP world, quite often we might want to limit that to 16 or 8 bits per sample. And then you start to limit the number of possible values you can have quite severely. Imagine you have 8 bits. That means you have 8 ones or zeros. The total possible number of values you can store is 2 to the 8, which is 256. You can have 256 possible values. So these three things are the real defining things about the change from the sort of theoretical lecture I gave last lecture to real practical signal processing. So let's just think about them for a second. Digital discrete time, it's almost reverse order I guess, but discrete time means we take our signal, which is this blue curve, and we sample it at distinct time points. Now, I'm going to try and indicate this where I think it's important for us by, instead of drawing a continuous curve, I'm going to draw spikes like this with a little dot on them to indicate that I have discrete samples. I might not always do that with every single piece of data that I show you, but for the first few lectures I want to try and make the distinction clear. So typically the red signals would be what we'd actually store in our computer, but it gets worse than that. We can't store the actual values, we can store some discrete set of possible values. So the horizontal dotted lines show the levels that I can actually store, and you can see I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So I would need 3 bits to store those possible values. Now, those 3 bits, you can see they... one thing I should note, my Macintosh for some reason doesn't like minus signs. So you notice little squares instead of minus signs. Okay, so you have these discrete levels. The discrete levels don't have to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You can see they can map to anything I like, as long as I know what that mapping is. They can map to any set of values, but there is a discrete set of levels. Typically, we uniformly space them over some interval. You can see these are uniformly spaced. You don't have to do it that way, but most people will by default, unless there's a good reason not to. So faster sampling, we get a better approximation of our signal. So this red curve is showing me my approximation. Because think about it, when I have a sample like this, it's going to be an approximation to the curve. You can see it's not exactly on the curve. You can see I don't know what's going on in between. So the faster my sampling, the better a curve I get. The higher my resolution, the finer my quantization, the better an approximation to that curve I'm going to get. And I'll talk about a bit more of the math of that in a minute. The other thing that we have to deal with is the fact that our signal is finite. Now, who's going to tell me what curve that is? What curve would you say that was?
It's a line.
It looks like a straight line. I mean, just naively you might say it's even a constant. But you can see that this value is a little bit smaller than that value. It looks like a straight line to me though. Do you think it is a straight line? Actually, it's the very first bit of this cosine curve. What's the point I'm trying to make? Well, if I have a short segment of a curve, it introduces some ambiguity. If I just look at that, it's very hard to tell the difference between that and a cosine curve. So having a finite signal limits your ability to distinguish between some sorts of signals. It also introduces an effect we'll call leakage, and I'll talk about that later on in the lecture. So how do we actually do sampling? Well, I'm not going to talk about the hardware and how you actually go about physically doing sampling. I'm going to look at the sort of mathematical properties of sampling. And how we imagine you do it is you take some function and we take some sampling interval. Ts is going to be the interval between my samples. N is an integer. And I just record the value of that function at those sample times, N times Ts. Now I'm just going to call them xn. So when I'm talking about my function, my continuous function, I'm typically going to give it some sort of letter like f. When I talk about a discrete signal, say f of t, I'll call it x of n, where n is going to be an integer here. The sampling frequency is just one on the sampling interval. So if I sample, say, my sampling interval is half a second, then my sampling frequency will be 2 samples per second. For example, the sampling frequency for CDs is 44.1 kHz. That's 44.1,000 samples per second. Now, sampling introduces a problem called aliasing. So what I've done here is I took this green curve and I sampled it at these red points along here. Now, I've also drawn a blue curve here. This green curve is a sine curve with a particular frequency. This blue curve is a different sine curve with a different frequency. They give me the same samples. So once I've made these samples, I could never go back and tell the difference between these two curves, these two functions. This is one of the key things I'm going to talk about today. This is a property called aliasing. When we talk about, say, supervillains, In cartoons, the alias is another name they use. It's another name they might use when they're being a supervillain, so that you can't connect them to their real job and their real life. Here we have an alias between two functions. We have the green curve and the blue curve, and they look exactly the same to us when we sample. The important thing about these sampling points is we throw away everything in between them, so we don't get to know any of that stuff. And so we lose the ability to tell the difference between these two curves. We call this aliasing, and we can do some mathematical analysis of it. But first note that it's not just two functions that are being aliased here. Look, there's another green function there. And it also passes through all of those exact sample points. In fact, there are an infinite number of different sine curves which will be aliased to that same set of sample points. How can we show this? Well, let's start out with a signal with frequency F0, and I'm just going to write a sine function. It's just going to be a sine function with frequency F0. Sampling interval TS and sampling frequency FS is 1 on TS. So my sampled signal is just F at the times NTS. So I'm going to put NTS in for T here. It gives me sine 2 pi F0 times NTS. But remember, with a sine function, I can always shift it by 2 pi. So I can take my sine function and I can put a phase change in here of 2 pi times some integer. That's just a shift in my sine function. It will have no change on the actual sine function. I can then take my m and I can put it inside this factor with 2 pi and take an NTS out front. Obviously I have to have a balancing factor of NTS underneath my m. And then I'm just going to change my m on NTS to be some value fs times k. So I have to take my value of n to be k times n to do that, but that's okay because k and n are going to both be integers. So get f of s times k in here. Now, this sine function is the same as the one that, or the samples I get from this sine function are the same as the samples I got from this one. But you notice the frequency has changed. The frequency in here has now had an integer multiple of this sampling frequency added to it. So that's what I did here. Actually, I took the samples from the blue curve, and then to get the green curve, I added an integer multiple of the sampling frequency to it. To get the second green curve, I did the same thing again. I added an integer multiple of the sampling frequency. You notice this allows for us to have an infinite number of possible signals that all get aliased to give me these same values of xn. There's another aspect of this. Remember, the sine function is an odd function. So minus sine of minus is going to be equal to sine of the positive value of that. So there's also an ambiguity between F0 and minus F0. Something with frequency F0 or something with frequency minus F0 is going to give me the same potential set of samples. Potentially the same set of samples. We can work out exactly how this is all going to work, but the important thing is when we're dealing with real signals, this happens. If we had a complex signal, it wouldn't be quite so bad. When we're dealing with real signals, we get this type of property. Another way of understanding aliasing. So what I've done so far is show you that aliasing is going to happen, but I haven't shown you what to do about it. So now what we want to do is we want to work out how can we fix this? You know, because this is an issue. I mean, I'm going to take my signal and I'm going to sample it and suddenly I've lost information about it. I don't know what's going on in my signal anymore. So firstly, we have to work out what to do about this. The way we do that is by looking at a signal called a data train or a Dirac cone. Let me draw you a very quick picture of a Dirac cone. then looks like this, where this is the sampling interval. So Dirac comb is just a series of deltas spaced evenly between each other. You can't see it? Maybe if I turn a light on. Does that make it a bit easier to see? I have some better textures here that might make it easier. That's good. So this is my Dirac comb, just a series of delta functions spaced evenly. The interesting thing about a Dirac comb is its Fourier transform looks like this. The Fourier transform of a Dirac comb looks like a Dirac comb. Now, I'm not going to bother to try and prove that to you. It's a little bit complicated to actually prove. The important thing that we can get from this is the fact that as soon as we have our Dirac comb, instead of writing my sampled function, I can write my sampled function like this. I can write it x of t times a Dirac sampling function. So this is just a time scaling of my Dirac function so that the samples are spaced, here they're spaced integers apart, here it's going to have a spacing of Ts times by my actual function. Now, this is where our convolution theorem comes in. Remember, when we take the Fourier transform of a product, what do we get? Okay, the Fourier transform of the convolution, what do we get? A product. Now by the duality theorem, if we take the Fourier transform of a product, we get a convolution. Simple. Just gonna plug my computer into the power before the battery runs out. So, what does this mean? Well, we take the Fourier transform of our delta comb. It's got a time scaling in here, so we represent that by a time scaling here. You notice we get a delta comb T of S times S, which is why we have a 1 on TS spacing here. We don't care too much about this scale factor at the moment. What we end up with is our Fourier transform of this sampled signal will be the convolution of the Fourier transform of a delta train with the Fourier transform of our signal. So this is what that looks like. Imagine I have some sort of signal and this is its Fourier transform, or rather this could be its power spectrum. And what I'm going to do is convolve that with a delta train. And that delta train is going to have a spacing of 1 on TS. What does that do to my signal? Well, what it does is it repeats the signal periodically. So I get my signal here, and that appears in the middle here, and then I get repeated versions of that with the same spacing as this delta train here. Let that digest for just a second. This is kind of important. This is something that you need to remember. We take our Fourier transform of delta train, we get this delta train, we convolve it with the Fourier transform of our signal, so this is frequency along the x-axis, and we get repeated copies of that Fourier transform in the signal domain. Now, imagine I start out with this signal. We call this signal a band-limited signal. Why would we call it band-limited? Because the band that has power in it is limited. When we talk about frequencies, we talk about bands of frequency, sometimes bandwidth. So this is the bandwidth of this signal. It's a band-limited signal because all of the signal is limited to being in this band here. When I repeat it like this, I get a spectrum. So this is the spectrum of my sampled signal, and you can see this ambiguity creeping in here. I had a signal here, but it appears here, and it appears here, appears here. It could be any one of those things. But if I started out by saying, my signal is band limited, I know my signal is limited to this band, then I can say, well, that can't be real. That's an aliasing artifact. These green bits are all aliasing artifacts. I know that because I know that I started out with a signal that was band limited. This is the key thing about aliasing. If we start out with a signal where we know its property is that it's band limited in some way, then we can sample in such a way that we can get rid of these ghosts, we can get rid of these aliases, we can ignore them. We can say that's not real. But we have to be a bit careful here. Because what's happened here? Well, I started with a band limited signal, but these times weren't quite far enough apart, so I ended up with an overlap here. So some of this green guy has got mixed in with some of the blue guy. So even if I ignore all the stuff out here, I'm still going to get some extra signal power in here that's aliased power. That overlap is something that I have to avoid. So how can I avoid that overlap? Well, the thing to do would be to make these guys go farther apart. What's the spacing on these? It's 1 on TS or F of S. So I have to make F of S bigger. So to avoid this aliasing, I have to sample faster. I have to increase my sampling frequency. That's what we do. In fact, there's a thing called the Nyquist sampling theorem. And what this says is that if we sample with our sampling frequency FS greater than 2 times FC, where FC is the sort of bandwidth of the signal, as long as F of S is 2 times FC, then aliasing won't be a problem. We won't get this overlap. So if you look in this case, my F of S is 2, and my bandwidth here is less than 2. You can see this is minus 1 and this is 1. The bandwidth here is less than 2. Actually, the bandwidth here is this thing. The thing I care about for purposes of this. It's actually less than 1. So here's an example of the way we can exploit this sort of thing. Now, this is an analog signal spectrum, and I've deliberately filtered my signal before I did anything to it. How do I assume my signal is going to be band limited? I filter it in the analog domain. I make sure that it's band limited. So take my analog signal, and this would be its Fourier transform or its power spectrum if I just took that signal and did a Fourier transform or a power spectrum of it. I'm going to call this FC, it's 20 megahertz, and I'm going to have this band, this actual width of this thing be 5 megahertz. So there's two things you note here. Firstly, the largest frequency in here is 22.5 megahertz. So naively, I would say the Nyquist frequency I need to use is going to be 22.5 times 2, which will be 45 megahertz. I'd have to sample 45 million times per second to get no aliasing. So I'd have to sample, this is my maximum frequency, this is the sort of critical frequency, I have to sample twice as fast as that. Actually, I can cheat, well, this is what would happen if I did that. Sorry. What I get is a replica of this purple guy here. What have I done? So what that would do is that would create periodic copies of this thing out here, but there'd be nothing in here. I can exploit the fact that I know this band is just 5 megahertz. So what I've done here is sample, instead of sampling at 45 megahertz, I've sampled at 17.5 megahertz. And what that does, remember, is it convolves our signal with this delta train, which means I get periodic repetitions of that signal. The repetition, the distance between them is 17.5 megahertz. So what happens is this purple guy gets repeated at 17.5 megahertz intervals, and this green guy gets repeated at 17.5 megahertz intervals. Now, do you notice any overlaps here? No. In fact, I can do this even more extremely. What I've done here is sample at 15 megahertz, and I'm repeating my purple signal every 15 megahertz in the frequency domain. Here I've sampled at 11.25 megahertz. You notice that we're just about getting to the point where we get some sort of overlap. We're using up all of our space now. What's 11.25? Well, it's getting close to 10. 10 is 2 times our 5 megahertz bandwidth. The important thing about microsampling theorem is that we have to make sure we don't get any overlap in the frequency domain. So if this guy is 5 megahertz wide, we can do that as long as we sample at greater than 2 times that 5, 2 times 10. Good idea not to push your issues too much. Good idea not to make it 2 times. Good idea not to sample at, say, 10, because then these gaps would get to be 0, and you'd be relying very strongly on how good your analog filters were, how well band limited your signal actually is. This is a very idealized picture. Real signals tend to, they drop down, but they have a little bit of a dribble down there. We'll talk about that later in the course. So the point here is, as long as we sample it 2 times the width of this, the bandwidth of this guy, we'll be okay. We won't get any aliasing. In this particular case, we get a couple of beneficial properties as well. Well, firstly, this sampling rate is 1/4 the sampling rate that we would have had to sample at. That's going to save us money. Sampling at a lower rate means we can use cheaper hardware. That's going to save us money. Secondly, we don't need to look at this bit of the spectrum. We can look at this bit of the spectrum. In fact, we could just look at this part of it. These are all repeats of each other. You know, the green bit is just a flip, a reflection of the purple bit. So we don't need to look at this whole spectrum. We can just look at this little bit here. And in fact, if we took this signal now and we put it through a low-pass filter such that we got rid of all of these bits, so we just kept this, and then we put it through a digital analog converter, we'll get a signal with just these bits in it. So what we'll have done is reduce the signal rate. We'll have taken a signal that was up here at 20 megahertz, and it will now be in the band up to 5 megahertz. This means we end up with a real signal, an analog signal, which might be easier to deal with in our hardware. So we can use this sort of technique as a way of changing the frequency of our signal. Obviously, if we sample too slowly, though, we get aliasing here. We get overlaps with these guys, and that's bad. So this is what we want to try and avoid. So the Nyquist sampling theorem is something that you should keep in mind whenever you're designing one of these sorts of systems. As I said, when we design something like this, the first thing we have to do is make sure that that analog signal, that continuous signal, is band limited. Now, you could just hope that that was going to be true. You could say, well, I'm building a radar, and it's going to be sending out these radar signals at that particular frequency, so I'm going to say it will be band limited. You should never do that, because you'll get noise creeping into your signal. You'll get extraneous interference creeping into it. So you have to make sure that that signal is actually band limited. And the way you do that is you put the signal through an analog bandpass filter. Now, I'm not going to tell you at all about how to design them. If you're doing electrical engineering, you'll no doubt be taught how to design those sort of filters at some point. It requires you building actual circuits, though. Can't do that in DSP. This is a physical thing. This is not something that we can do in a computer. Then we do our analog to digital converter, which takes our signal and creates these samples. Again, this is a hardware device, but it's on the edge of this digital domain. As I pointed out as well, we shouldn't push the boundaries here. When you design these real devices, they always have noise, they always have issues. Bandpass filters are not perfect filters. The sample clock that generates these sample times might not produce sample times that are absolutely spot on the times that you think they are. There might be imperfections in the quantization process. So when you design one of these guys, you shouldn't push the boundaries. You should always leave guard bands for this Nyquist band, and so on. Oh, and I have another little example of aliasing to show you, if it works. So this is a little animation of a car driving along, and you can see the wheels are spinning forward. One of the things that you may have seen watching movies from places like Hollywood is a scene in the movie where this sort of thing happens. The car is moving forward, but the wheels seem to be moving backward. Why would this happen? Well, think about what a movie is actually doing. A movie is taking a series of still pictures. We happen to do this fairly quickly, and if you run them together, what happens in your brain is it creates this image of something moving. But the movie itself is a series of still pictures. They are samples of the underlying scene that you're looking at. Typical movie these days is done at 24 frames per second. What I've done here is set up a situation where the think of the wheels moving around and around. It's a periodic behavior. So think of it that like your sine wave. What I've done here is set up a situation where that sine wave, that periodic behavior, is being aliased. Visually, our brain is seeing it as a low frequency signal where the wheels are going backwards instead of a high frequency signal where they're going forward quite quickly. This is an aliasing artifact. What I want to bring you around to is aliasing happens in a lot more areas than just this sort of simplistic idea of sines and cosines. We'll have a look in the next lecture at some two-dimensional examples of images where you get aliasing artifacts. But the point here is that aliasing is a rather more general property than just a sort of sine-cosine artifact. I'm going to talk a little bit about quantization. Remember, quantization is this thing of we take our signal and we can't actually record the value of the blue curve. We record the nearest possible one of our quantization levels. So the way we typically do this is we assume that we have B bits. When we have B bits, the largest possible value we can represent is going to be 2 to the B minus 1 times some delta. Delta is just the distance between these levels. The smallest possible value other than zero that we can represent is going to be delta. Now this assumes that all of our values are going to be positive. When we assume one of our values could be positive or negative, we have to lose one of these bits to the sign. One of those bits becomes a sign value. I'm going to ignore that for the moment, but imagine you had 8 bits for a signal. Really, you only have 7 bits for the values and you have 1 bit for the sign. So let's just assume our B is going to be 7 instead of 8. The largest possible value is just going to be 2 to the B minus 1 times our delta. The smallest value other than 0 is going to be delta. We call the ratio of these two things the dynamic range of our quantization. Why dynamic range? Well, it tells us the range from the smallest sound, for instance, that we could record up to the loudest sound that we could record. The smallest sine wave or the smallest signal that we could record would have peaks around this sort of size, delta. The largest sine wave that we could record would have peaks around this value. we try to make our sine wave any bigger, what happens is we get clipping. Instead of getting a signal that looks like a sine, like this, where, you know, these are my levels, I get a signal that looks like this. The tops of the sine wave that should have gone up there get clipped off. And that introduces really, really noticeable distortion into sound. Interestingly, people sometimes deliberately do this. Can anyone think of why you might deliberately do this? Absolutely. This is what you do with a guitar when you're trying to get distortion for playing things like heavy metal. How do you do it in a guitar? Well, typically guitar amps, analog devices, what you do is you have two amplifier stages and you basically kick one of those amplifier stages into the point where it starts clipping. But it's an analog effect for guitars and it has slightly different properties from the sort of clipping distortion that we would get with a digital device. But even so, the important thing is, if you let your device clip like this, you get a lot of noise. That's bad. So typically, this would, the largest signal we could have would have a range of this largest signal up here. So what is the ratio here? Well, as we usually do, we're going to look at the dynamic range in terms of dB. So we look at 20 log 10 of the ratio. Whenever we take... well, obviously the deltas cancel. We're going to approximate it for B, even reasonable sizes, say B 7 or 8. We don't have to worry about this minus 1. The log of 256 is very close to the log of 255. If we were going to be perfectly accurate about this, we would be a little bit more careful about these sort of details. I'm not going to try and get all of those tiny details right. Actually, in your notes, there's a reference to a book. Lyon's book does a much better analysis of dynamic range and noise from quantization. But we're going to use a, we're going to produce a, an approximate rule of thumb. So we end up rearranging our log, we get B times 20 log 10 of 2, which is 6.02 times B in dB. So what does this mean? It means you get roughly 6 dB per bit when you're quantizing in terms of dynamic range. So for example, CDs use 16 bits. Remember, one of those bits is going to be used for the sine. So we get 15 times 6. We get 90 dB of dynamic range. Now remember back when I looked at the range of levels of sound that we might listen to. 0 dB corresponded to the threshold of hearing. 130 dB was the threshold of pain. So there's 130 dB roughly of hearing that our ears can do. A CD can only replicate roughly 90 dB. A CD cannot get that entire range of sound. So is that a problem? Well, I don't find it to be a big problem. I don't like to listen to my stereo really, really loud, and I don't like to listen to it really, really quiet. So I don't think it's a problem for CDs. There was an issue though with LPs. LPs are long playing records. I don't know how many of you guys have actually ever seen a record. Maybe I'll bring one along at some point. These old vinyl records, they relied on a physical needle that was going to go along this groove and be kicked up and down by deviations in that groove on vinyl. And this was not, in some ways, the most fantastic way of reproducing sound. It worked for a good, you know, 70 or 80 years pretty well. But its dynamic range was limited for typical records to something like 70 dB. One of the things that you often heard from audiophiles, hi-fi fanatics, when CDs first came out, is that they would get a CD of an LP that they'd listen to, and they'd listen to the CD and they'd say, well, you know, maybe it's got 90 dB, but it doesn't sound any better to me. Why was that? Well, what happened when people were producing LPs, remember, your range of sounds could be more than 70 dB. One of the skills of a studio producer is to take your sound, take your record, and compress it into that 70 dB so that you could make a nice record, a record that sounded nice. What happened when they pressed the first few CDs is they just took the same master track that they started with, which had been compressed into 70 dBs, and they put it onto a CD. So they didn't use the full dynamic range of that CD. They left 20 dB of dynamic range out of it. Nowadays, you sometimes see people talking about digitally remastered CDs that you can buy. What's meant to have happened here, I don't know if it always does happen, but what's meant to have happened is they went back to the original master reels, the original recordings on high quality tape, and they reproduced that music so that it could use that full 90 dB. So they didn't try and compress it as much into that 70 dB. So if you get a digitally remastered CD and you compare it to one of these old first press CDs, it should have more colourful sound. You should get this higher range from quiet sounds to really loud sounds. Actually, it probably doesn't matter for most pop music. Most pop music, you're not going to hear most of that. You have to be listening to something a little bit interesting to be able to get that dynamic. You know, Britney Spears doesn't use 70 dB. She doesn't use 90 dB. She's not use all of that dynamic range. Doesn't matter too much for that. The other aspect of this is noise. So we talked about dynamic range, but when we quantize, we introduce noise. So if I take this guy and I move into here, what do I mean by noise? Noise is errors. Noise is artifacts in the sound. I've taken my signal and instead of recording this value, I record a value a little bit away from it. That's noise. How big is that noise? Well, you can see from this picture that imagine this distance here is delta. The magnitude of this guy is going to be of the order of delta. The magnitude of my signal, imagine that I have a signal which fills up like this, fills up the whole dynamic range. The magnitude of the signal is going to be approximately this value. So the noise that gets introduced for a signal like that where we fill up the range is also going to be the ratio of this value to delta. It's also going to be around 6 dB per bit. Now, there are a few little changes. There's many ways you can improve this formula. Firstly, notice that I say the error is of the order of delta. Actually, the error is going to be a little bit smaller than delta. And the error is not going to be uniformly distributed. The error is going to have some sort of statistical distribution. So we can model that a bit more accurately. I'm not going to try and do that for you here. Just refer you to the book by Lyons to have a look if you're really interested in detailed formula. But the important things about this formula to remember, 6 dB per bit, that's roughly your quantization noise. But it relies on you filling the channel, so you have to have a signal which is going to use up all of these guys. It's no good having a signal like this. Have a signal like this, then the noise is going to be of the same order as the signal. Remember, the important thing with noise is not how big the noise is, it's how big the noise is with respect to the signal. So this is bad. This means that the noise is about the same size as the signal. The other thing, remember clipping. If you overfill that thing, if you quantize so that you don't fill it all up, or your signal actually gets too big for those quantization levels, then you get clipping. And clipping introduces many, many orders of magnitude more noise. And that noise has harmonic properties. So clipping is a bad thing for most signal analysis. There are rare occasions like guitar distortion where people deliberately seek it out. So for example, our CD, 16 bits, 44.1 kilohertz, 90 dB dynamic range. We imagine that the noise in this is going to be of the order of 90 dB as well. Human hearing goes up to 15 kilohertz. We were originally dealing with records that had 70 dB, now we've got 90 dB. You would think, given CD characteristics, it would produce audio that was basically perfect, that a human ear couldn't tell the differences. Actually, you still get people who say that CDs distort sound, they change it a little bit. There are a couple of reasons that people quote occasionally for this. Firstly, harmonics. Even though we can't hear sounds above 15 kilohertz, there's an argument that they still influence the sounds that we hear. Remember, I talked about harmonics and how they influence tone of musical instruments. To be honest, I don't know if that argument has any teeth. People use it sometimes. It depends a lot on how your ear works, whether that makes any sense or not. And I don't know enough about psychoacoustics of your ear. Your ear is a highly nonlinear device. It's very, very clever. It's got, as I said, much more dynamic range than these very clever DSP sort of tricks. So it's actually a very amazing device. Who knows what it actually is capable of. The other thing is that all of the analysis that I talked about so far talks about nice sine waves, which are continuous sine waves that go on forever. Real signals are transient. Transients introduce, imagine you have a signal which goes like this and then stops. There's a sharp edge here. That introduces high frequency components into your signal. That sharp edge, those high frequency components are being cut off by this sampling, or by the filter that you put, the analog filter that you put in before you do the sampling. Another thing to remember, although 44.1 kHz is the sampling rate, people put an analog filter in front of this. And as I said, you don't want to push the limits of it. You don't want to try and record 22 kHz sounds. So people often have their analog filter a bit lower than that. So I don't think they would put it down to 15 kHz, but that's going to cut off a little bit more of the signal as well. So there are a bunch of reasons why CDs may not perfectly reproduce sound from the point of view of some hi-fi fanatic sort of person. The latest standards for audio recording actually have faster sampling rates and more bits. So people are pushing that up a little bit for things like DVD audio. On the other hand, I can't tell the difference, seriously. And I would guess that most people can't tell the difference between a CD and the real sound that was being recorded. You need to, yep. So that's an interesting thing. MP3 is actually going the other way, and we'll talk a little bit about compression later on in this course. But compression, lossy compression like MP3s do, actually reduces the quality a little bit. So there's no point in taking an even higher quality signal and trying to compress it, because you'll lose quality anyway. In the discrete domain, there's a discrete set of transforms, and the ones that we're typically most concerned with are things like the Fourier transform, the discrete cosine transform, the discrete wavelet transform, the Z transform. There's another one called the probability generating function, which we're not really going to look at in this course, but again, another transform, actually very closely related to the Z transform. So we're going to mainly look at the Fourier transform, at least in the start of this course, and then we'll start talking about some of the other transforms later on. So imagine you have your continuous Fourier transform. Remember, this is our definition up here. We're going to take our signal. Remember, this is our finite signal, so we have a product of our signal with a delta train. This is our signal sample points. At the point 0 to n minus 1, so this is for a finite signal. The Fourier transform, if we just take this definition of the Fourier transform of this signal, then we end up with something that looks like this. I've just taken this and plugged it in here and used the property, the shifting property of the delta function. So this is easy enough for us to compute. There's one issue here though. S is still a continuous variable. Now, in our original signal, we had n points, n sample points. But now, we've gone from a signal which had n sample points, and we've gone to a domain, a Fourier domain or a frequency domain, where we have a continuous variable here. That's a waste. I have n points here, I can represent that. I know there's only n pieces of data, but here I have an infinite number of pieces of data. There must be some redundancy there. Redundancy means I have extra information, information I don't need to keep. As it turns out, I can get rid of a whole bunch of that. I only need to compute my Fourier transform for this discrete data had a set of points S equals K on big N, TS. N is my number of samples, TS is the sampling interval, remember, and K is just a series of intervals. So typically we write this as big X, K, where K is just an integer, and this is going to be my discrete transform. And you notice, instead of S in here, I have K on N. Now I have, for my discrete signal, I have a discrete set of transform points. And one of the nice things about this is obviously it's invertible, so we can write our discrete Fourier transform like this, we can write our inverse discrete Fourier transform like that. What does invertible mean? Well, it means we didn't lose any information, obviously, because we can go there and then we can come back. So this is a complete set of information. There are other ways you could define this Fourier transform, and I'll talk about them in a few minutes maybe. But this is the standard definition that many, many people use. This is the definition that MATLAB uses, for instance. Other people do use other definitions, so you have to be aware of that. Again, the same as we had with the continuous Fourier transform. You have to be aware that they might be using an alternate definition, but this is the definition we use. What else should I say about that? Well, here's a little example of taking one of those transforms. I have a couple of examples like that of the Fourier transform and the inverse Fourier transform, just for your information and also to help you do the class exercise. You notice there are a few problems a bit like that in the class exercise. One of the things that's going on here is our discrete signal is just a vector with n terms. So it's a vector in n-dimensional space. Our transform is a linear transform. Now you should know from first year that any linear transform in an n-dimensional vector space can just be written as a matrix multiplication. So we know now that our Fourier transform, the linear transform, it can just be written as a linear transform. Just be written as a matrix multiplication like this. And the inverse can be written like this. So obviously we want a matrix A that's going to be an invertible matrix. This is why we know we only need n sample points in the Fourier domain, because for A to be invertible, it has to be an n by n matrix. If it was, say, n by n minus 1, then it wouldn't be invertible. So we need to have at least n points in the Fourier domain for this to be an invertible matrix. Likewise, if n had 100 extra points, that wouldn't help us. It wouldn't give us any extra information. It wouldn't make A more invertible. There's no such thing as more invertible. So having those extra data points wouldn't help us. So the fact that this A needs to be a square matrix tells us that X is also going to be a vector with n terms in it. So we can get these things from simple linear algebra. This is stuff, again, go back and look at your first year math notes if you're not getting what I'm talking about with matrix multiplication here. What do the matrices look like? Well, here's a big example. This looks kind of ugly, but actually you notice it's got a lot of patterning in it. You go down this row and if you get 1, 2, 3, 4, up to n minus 1. Here it goes 2, 4, 6, up to n minus 1 times 2. Here it's n minus 1, n minus 2 times n minus 1, 3 times n minus 1, and so on. Likewise, you go along here, you see 1, 2, up to n minus 1. Here it goes 2, 4. There's a lot of structure in this matrix. And actually, we're going to exploit that structure in the next lecture when we talk about the fast Fourier transform. One of the issues here, how many operations does it take to do one of these matrix multiplications? Well, we do matrix multiplications all the time in first year with 3x3 matrices. That's pretty easy. But what happens if you have a million points in your signal? That would make this matrix a million by 1 million matrix. That would mean it's got 10 to the 12 elements. So even storing that matrix on your computer would be a pain. So this is not a great way of implementing a Fourier transform. It takes order n squared operations. Order n squared means when we take this Fourier transform, it takes some factor times n squared number of operations in order to calculate the Fourier transform. It requires n squared storage, unless you're very clever about how you do it. So this is not a great way of doing Fourier transforms, particularly when the data becomes long. There's a thing there called the fast Fourier transform, which we'll talk about later. So here's a little example. Again, I'm not going to go into the details of these, but they give you ways of doing it. Talking about various things, think about frequency resolution. Now remember what our k, we have in the frequency domain, we just have x of k, where k is just going to be an integer. So x of k means you have some power, some frequency, but k doesn't tell you the frequency. The, you know, if k is 2 here, that doesn't mean you have 2 hertz signals. It depends on the sampling interval, it depends on the length of the data. So if you want to work out the sampling, the frequency based on one of these guys, you have to do a little bit of translation. So how do we do that? We say, well, we have a signal with n samples, the sampling frequency is f of s, then the length of the signal is going to be n divided by f of s, or n times tf, n times the sampling interval. That's how long our signal is going to be. We convert from, we do a little bit of rearrangement. What have I done there? All I've done is take 1 on t and multiplied it by this k, and I'm going to get something like mfs on n. I should probably have a k here actually. It should be kfs on n. What does that mean? Well, if I take one of these guys, I can translate it into an actual frequency by taking k times fs on n. So that's useful when I'm plotting graphs, obviously. If I take my graph and I want to make it have an axis which has the right values on it instead of k being 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's useful, particularly say I'm using MATLAB or something like this. I can use this to work out what those values should be. Notice I should have a k here, not an n. The other thing it tells us is the frequency resolution. Now the idea of resolution is if you have two signals with different frequencies, can you tell them apart? The answer is if they're further apart than your resolution, you can tell them apart. So imagine I have my samples, my x, big X, k, big X, k plus 1. Those two things are going to be separated by fs on n. So this is my frequency resolution. This is the smallest interval between two frequencies where I can tell that there's two frequencies there. I can separate them out. Things to notice about this. Well, if I increase n, I increase the number of samples, that reduces the resolution. That means I get finer resolution. I don't quite know, it reduces the resolution, makes it sound like it's worse. It's actually better. It improves the resolution. It makes the interval between two frequencies smaller. It makes the smallest frequency you can see smaller. This is directly analogous to that example I showed you earlier where you have that cosine function. If you have a small range of samples, a small amount of time, small length of observations, you can't tell that cosine from a linear curve. But if you have a long set of observations, a large value of n, then you can tell the difference. Really, instead of thinking about fs on n, we really care about 1 on t. The longer t is, the longer our observation period, the more resolution power we have. That's why f of s comes in here. But notice that higher sampling frequencies reduce our resolution. So if we increase the sampling frequency, then that removes, that means for a set of data of the same length, we get less resolving power. Why is that? Well, that means the higher sampling frequency to the same number of samples means that we have a shorter time of observation. So we can't tell the difference between these signals because we have a shorter observational. As I said, getting the units right, remember when we take our frequency, this is probably bad notation using FNL analysis M. This is telling us the frequency, the actual frequency. It's how we convert units when we're taking our Fourier transform and converting it into something here. alternate definitions. Here's a couple of alternate, or one alternate definition of the discrete Fourier transform. You can see all that's happened is the scaling has changed. One thing I should point out here is that when we're looking at most signals, we don't actually care very much about the absolute values of these guys. What we care about is the relative values of them. So changing the scaling factor when we do the transform, so we go from 1 on n to 1 on squared n, that doesn't really matter, because typically what we care about is relative values. Remember, the power scale, the dB scale, is always a relative scale. So we care about, you know, whether the peak of the signal, the highest frequency peak, is 60 dB above the noise. We don't care about whether it's just 60 dB absolutely. We care about how much it is above the noise. We care about these ratios of powers. We don't care about absolute values of powers in most cases. When we do changes to the signal, we're going to do some sort of alteration to it. We don't care about the absolute value of that signal. We just care about what distortion happens to that signal. Now, that's not always true. Remember, when we're sampling, we have to make sure that our quantization levels are at about the right level to capture that signal appropriately. So it's not always true that we don't care about magnitudes, but most of the time it doesn't matter, particularly when we're taking Fourier transforms like this. Properties of the discrete Fourier transform. Well, one of the reasons I spent a few minutes talking about continuous Fourier transforms is because most of the properties are the same. Most of the properties of the discrete Fourier transform are exactly the same, or very direct analogs of the properties of the Fourier transform, the continuous Fourier transform that we looked at earlier. Why I prove the properties with integrals? Well, sometimes proofs are a little bit easier with integrals than they are with sums. Actually, sometimes they're easier with sums as well, so it's just convenient to do it that way. But I'm not going to go through all of these properties again, but you should know them. The one that I want to emphasize once again, if we have a convolution and we take its Fourier transform, we get a product. Remember this. This is a really, really important thing. If you don't know this, you're going to fail the exam. Learn this property of convolutions. Understand what a convolution is, because I will ask you questions about it in the exam. Okay. Now that we're in the discrete domain, there are some properties that are unique to the discrete domain. Things that happen only in the discrete domain. We can't have an analog to them in the continuous domain. And the three that I'm going to highlight are leakage, padding, and similarity. And I'm going to give you the details, or some of the details, for each of these. But note that leakage in particular, we're going to spend a lot more time talking about leakage in, I think, lecture 7 perhaps, when we talk about windowing functions. So I'm not going to spend too much time on leakage today. The point of leakage is, what I have here is a nice signal. It's periodic. You can see it's a periodic signal. It's a sine wave. The important thing about this signal is its period is an exact, it fits exactly into here. It's exactly frequency 3. There's 3 cycles within this measurement period. Exactly. You know, if I took this signal and I added another one that looked like it directly afterwards, it would still look like a sine wave. It would be perfectly repeated if I just repeated it like that. And lo and behold, when I look at its power spectrum, you see one peak, and let's look along here, it goes 0, 1, 2, 3. 3 is where it happens. Notice the frequency of this is 3 cycles per measurement period. That's what this 3 really means along here. It means you have 3 cycles per the measurement period. But what happens if I put a signal in here which doesn't exactly fit? Okay, so here this frequency I think is 3.4. What's happening here? 3.4, clearly it doesn't fit. There's no one of these guys that perfectly represents that value. So you get the signal being spread over a few values. There's a peak at 3, but there's still a value at 4. Why is that? Well, I will talk, as I said, a lot more about this in lecture 7. For the moment, there's a couple of ways of thinking about it. firstly, think about each of these guys. The actual value is 3.4, so the real value has just been spread over a couple of values. That sort of makes sense to me. I mean, 3.4, so I've got a big peak at 3, a slightly smaller peak at 4. It doesn't really explain why I get peaks down here, or values down here. This is 6. Why, I mean, I have a peak at 3.4, why would I get power at 5 and 6? Okay. We will understand this in much greater detail later on, why it gets spread so widely. Even though, you know, I've just taken 3.4, it's still between 3 and 4. The other way to think of each of these guys, each of these peaks, each of these spikes, or each of these points, in fact, think of it as a little bandpass filter. And what this filter does is it tries to filter out all of the signal between, say for this guy, 20. It's trying to filter out all of the signal between 19.5 and 20.5. It's trying to filter them out. When I say trying to, it's not a perfect filter. It's very hard to design perfect filters. So what it's doing is it's actually filtering out mostly that, but it's getting some other things creeping in. So for instance, this guy, this is doing the right thing. It's getting all the frequencies between 2.5 and 3.5. But this guy, he's trying to get 3.5 to 4.5. That, it's not a perfect filter, so it's letting in some of the power from 3.4. Likewise, this is not a perfect filter. It's still letting in some power from over here. So this is another way of thinking about these little spikes, as if they're bandpass filters. Another way of thinking about it is if, imagine you took this signal and you repeated it. One of the implications of the Fourier transform, imagine I have a spike here. That means I have a frequency of 3. But its implication is that frequency goes on forever. But this is a finite signal, so that spike at 3 would mean that I took that signal and I'd have to repeat it on forever. But you know I have a finite signal. What would happen if I took this signal and repeated it on forever? I'd get this little edge bit which didn't quite match up. That sharp discontinuity introduces additional frequencies into the signal, which then gets spread out around here. So leakage is a really interesting phenomenon, and as I said, I'm going to talk a bit more about it later on. I think it's a really interesting insight into what the Fourier transform is actually doing. So it's worth thinking about a little bit, and we will talk about it some more. These are just words saying the same thing that I've just been saying with that picture, so I'm not going to go into any detail. We talk about padding and packing a signal. What do I mean by this? Well, one of the things that you often need to do is add some zeros on the end of a signal. Why might you want to do this? Well, for instance, there are many algorithms that work best if a signal is a particular length. Classic example of this, simple versions of the fast Fourier transform work best on signals which have a length which is a power of 2. But typically when you sample signals, you don't get an exact power of 2 as your length. So imagine I sample and I get 1,000 samples. Actually, to do my Fourier transform, I might want to have a signal which has 1,024 samples. So one thing that people sometimes do is they pack some zeros on the end. So they take their signal with a length 1,000 and they add 24 zeros so that the signal is 1,024, and they can use this algorithm that they're familiar with. There's another reason I'll explain in just a second. What happens when you do this? Well, so I'm going to take y to be my signal. My original signal has n data points, and I'm just going to take the first n data points of y to be my signal, and I'm going to add some zeros on the end. And to make life easy in terms of writing out the formulas, I'm going to add a large number of zeros. I'm actually going to take my original signal and have this number, say k, be 2, and I'm going to put an entire set of zeros, n zeros on the end of it. So let me draw a picture of that. Well, there's an example. I've taken my original signal and I've added 4 zeros. So k would be 2 in this particular case. Then, my Fourier transform of my signal y, or big Y of k, is going to be x of k on k. Now, there's a trick here. This only works for certain points. So let's have a look at this particular example. It should make it pretty obvious what's going on. what I've done is big K is 2 here, so I've taken my signal of length 4 and I've padded out to be length 8. The Fourier transform here of my signal 0, 1, 0, 0 is 1 minus I minus 1 I. So, if I look at Y0, that has to be equal to X0, so that's 1. Y2 has to be equal to X2 on 2. Have a look at this formula. I put Y1, so Y2 in here. 2 on 2 gives me 1, so that gives me X1. So Y2 is equal to minus I. That's just this value here. Y4 is equal to X2, this value here, minus 1. And Y6 is equal to I, which is this value here. Where do the other values come from? Well, you can sort of see them as interpolants between here. So if I took 1 and added this guy, 1 and minus I gives me 1 minus I, and then it's been divided by square root 2. It's sort of like an interpolated value, such that its power is conserved. This is this guy, add these two guys together, minus 1 minus 2 divided by square root 2. The square root 2 factor, though, is not something that I'm trying to explain to you. I'm just trying to give you an idea of why this value comes about. So this can be useful for a couple of reasons. One reason is this fact that sometimes you want to pad out a signal and now we want to work out its Fourier transform. Another one might be, say I give you a problem which looks like this and tell you to work out its Fourier transform. By solving this smaller problem, you get a good idea of what that Fourier transform is going to look like. Likewise, if I start out with these 4 digits, you can see it's actually got 2 zeros packed on the end, so I could use this 2-digit problem to solve my Fourier transform. So this gives you a way of making it a lot quicker, a lot easier for you to do the calculations to calculate a Fourier transform. So you can see Y0 equals X0 and so on. The other values not quite so easy to derive. So here's my example. A signal with length 32, you can see again it's just a simple sine. This is its frequency spectrum. You can see that I plotted the frequency spectrum from minus 15 to 15, and you can see it's symmetric. That must be, this is a power spectrum, remember. Actually, this is the absolute value of the discrete Fourier transform. I've written DCT there instead of DFT. So this is the absolute value, so it must be a symmetric function if we have a real signal coming in. What I'm going to do is pad it with k equal to 3, so I put 2 lots of 32 zeros up here to make the signal 96, and you can see that the spectrum I get looks almost the same. It's a little bit different, and the thing that's happened is I've kind of got a smoother picture of my spectrum. So one of the reasons you might do this is to kind of interpolate your spectrum, and in fact in some of the plots I'm going to show you from time to time, particularly where I have, say, a filter which has a very small number of points in it, I will deliberately pack it out with zeros so I get a more interpolated, more smooth view of the spectrum to show you, just because it makes it easier to illustrate the shape of it than if I show you a few points like this. So that's another reason you might pad out a signal, is to get this more interpolated view of the signal. But notice there can't be any extra information here. This looks like there's more points, so there's more information, but these are all zeros. I didn't put any extra information there. To really get a proper view, a more interpolated view, I'd have to continue that actual signal over all of those data points. This is not really telling me anything new. So you have to be a little bit careful with this sort of thing when you're doing it. Okay, third property, similarity. This is a neat one as well. Again, we're going to put zeros into the signal, but this time we're going to space them between the data points. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a data point and then put some zeros. Then the next data point, then some zeros. The next data point and some zeros. So the way we write that mathematically is our signal Yn, for values of n equal to 0k, 2k, and so on, we're just going to let that be the signal, but everything else is going to be zeros. So I think I have an example of that here. Examples in a second. Examples here. So what I'm going to do is take a signal like this and intersperse zeros into that signal. The resulting Fourier transform, look, this part of the Fourier transform is just the Fourier transform of x, and that happens from 0 to n minus 1. Then I get a repeat of the same spectrum. What I get is a set of periodic repetitions of the same spectrum at intervals. So this is my section on quantization and zithering and half-toning, but I have my example here. This is a really nice property. So if I take my signal xn, and y is just that signal with these zeros added in, slotted in between them, then this is my Fourier transform of x. The Fourier transform of y, this is 1i minus I minus 1i, 1 minus I minus 1i, 1 minus I minus 1i. It's just this signal, Fourier transform, repeated two times. Because I've doubled the number of points here. So I repeat the signal twice. If I tripled the number of points here, I would repeat the signal three times. Repeat the Fourier transform three times. So this just tells you how to calculate the Fourier transform for a whole bunch of these sort of more complicated signals. It's also a very useful property for us in terms of applications. One of the things that you quite often want to do is change the sampling rate of a signal. Now, remember, we're in the digital domain, so we can't just resample the signal. Naively, you might think, well, just change the sample points. But remember, when we sampled, we chucked out all of the data between those points. So we can't just resample the signal. Not naively like that. So we need to have ways of changing sample rates. Upsampling is a simple one of those. It's taking, say, a sample rate of 44.1 kHz and changing it to 88.2 kHz. Typically, we upsample by an integer multiple. Downsampling is the other way. We downsample by an integer multiple. And if you combine the two, upsample by an integer multiple, then downsample by a different integer multiple, you can resample by a rational number. And that gives you the ability to resample by a very, very, very sort of, a very flexible sort of way. So imagine we sampled every 2s seconds, so our sample rate is f of s, and we want to sample at rate kf of s. So how do we do that? How could we do that? Well, the way that this suggests this similarity property is what we do is we just interleave zeros. So say we want to upsample by k, we're going to interleave k minus 1 zeros between each data point in the time domain. That's a bit of text for you to read, but what's going to happen, we're going to take a signal like this, we're going to upsample it, we're going to put two zeros, in this case k is 3, so put two zeros between every data point along here. Then I've taken the Fourier transform. And what do you see? Well, you see the spectrum that we started with, this spectrum, and it's just been repeated three times. So that upsampling, that adding those zeros, hasn't quite done the upsampling job for us. And that makes sense, because if I just took a signal like this and fed it into a digital analog converter, I get something that sounded pretty weird out of it, because there's a whole lot of, you know, 1 0 1 0, whole lot of transition. It would sound awful. Why would it sound awful? Well, there's all these frequency components up here that I've introduced into my signal. So I have to get rid of them. How would I do that? Well, you just filter the signal. We're going to talk about filters in I think lecture 4 or 5. What does a filter do? Well, it gets rid of some of the frequency components. Here, this red curve is showing the filter I've used. It's a perfect filter. All I've done is take out these frequency components in this domain, and then I've done an inverse transform, and I've got this signal. Now, let's go back to our original signal. You can see it's a sine wave. My upsampled signal, you can see it's a sine wave. So this did the right thing. The artifact that's introduced, you can see there's an artifact at the edge. It's not quite a sine wave at the edge. I'll tell you again why that is later on in our lectures. But think of it as a kind of smoothing off of this edge artifact. Now, what else is going on here? Well, this is what we call interpolation. We call it upsampling, but interpolation is another word for it. I took a series of points like this, and I worked out what the value was going to be in between them. There are a whole lot of different ways of doing interpolation. One of the ways that you probably come across in math is linear interpolation. One way of interpolating would be to draw a straight line between each of these data points. Or each of these data points, I should say. Draw a straight line. Straight lines, though, introduce corners. And those corners are discontinuities in the first derivative. Those discontinuities introduce artifacts into the signal. And those artifacts might be audible. Whereas this type of upsampling is a type of upsampling which makes sure that you get smooth curves joining these guys up. Another form of interpolation is spline-based interpolation, where you use cubic polynomials to fit these points and you interpolate that way. Spline-based interpolation uses cubic polynomials, so there's going to be a discontinuity in the fourth derivative. That discontinuity in the fourth derivative is still an artifact, and that appears in your signal. This type of interpolation is smooth. Another way of talking about it, people sometimes call it Shannon interpolation. The function that we've used here, I just talked about two sorts of interpolation. One uses linear segments, another uses cubic polynomials. This type of interpolation uses sinc functions. Talk about that a bit more later on in the course as well. Those sinc functions also introduce artifacts, but for many applications, they're less important artifacts. For audio applications, those artifacts are going to be less audible. This is one of the artifacts, the fact that we sort of smoothed off the edges. That's not a big deal if you have a long signal though. Okay. So notionally our upsampling, we insert zeros, then we do a low pass filter. Low pass filter just means we filter out the low signals, we pass the low frequencies, the frequencies that are small, and exclude the high frequencies. So we upsample, add the zeros, do a low pass. But you notice that my low pass filter, there's a lot more points when I do my low pass. That's computationally a pain if I have a long signal. So one of the things we can actually do is, if we're clever, we can rearrange the filter banks so we actually do the low pass filter and then upsample. This is a really neat trick because it means we do a low pass filter on the low sample rate and then we upsample. We have to be a little bit clever about how we do that, and again I'm going to talk about how to do that later on when we've talked a bit more about how to design filters. Resampling, as I said, one of the main applications might be audio, where you're going from one audio format to another audio format, say CD audio to DVD audio, which has a different sample rate. Important thing to notice, when I did this, did I introduce any new information? No. I introduced a bunch of zeros. That isn't information, that's just crap. So there's no new information here. Does this make the audio quality better? No. When you hear people talking about CD players, though, sometimes they talk about oversampling. So what they do, you know, your CD is doing 34.1 kHz. So what does it matter if you do oversampling? You don't get any new information. The CD, the actual physical CD, the thing that you're playing, doesn't have more bits on it when you have an oversampling CD player. So what does it mean? Well, one of the nice things is that when you have a signal which has a higher sampling rate, it's a little bit easier to design a digital to analog converter. The filters that you need in your digital to analog converter can be made a bit more cheaply. So what people sometimes do is they take their digital signal, which is 44.1 kHz, they upsample in the digital domain. Remember, digital domain means we have cheap hardware because it's following Moore's law. So in the digital domain, the hardware is cheap. We upsample, we filter, we do this, and then we put it through a digital to analog converter. The digital to analog converter is then a cheaper device. This is one of the reasons CD players got cheaper, is because the digital to analog converter, which has to involve analog circuitry, got cheaper. So this is one of the kind of cool things that you can do with this sort of upsampling. What are the other issues going on here? Well, I have a few more things I want to talk about. We might not finish everything here. But I've been talking about things like audio signals, the same sorts of sampling issues. They all apply to images as well, and to video. So imagine that you have your TV screen. Australia uses PAL as its TV standard. That's roughly 720 by 576 pixels when you look at it. But if you look at something like a workstation or a plasma TV, they have a different number of pixels. So if I want to take my PAL signal, my ordinary analog TV signal, and display it on my big plasma screen TV, I have to do some sort of resampling. I have to take a signal which has this many samples, this many pixels. Pixels are the individual elements of an image, I should say. Think of them as samples. I'm going to have to take those samples and I'm going to have to put them on a TV. Incidentally, I mean, one of the things that we should be thinking about here is, does any of this digital stuff, this aliasing, does that apply to us? Does it apply to our eye? Does it apply to CCD cameras? Because they've got pixels. They're doing discrete sampling. Well, honestly, what happens with things like your eye is not a perfect device. It samples as well. Remember, in your retina, you have these little cells called cones and rods, and they sample the light coming in. The resolution is very high. The sampling rate is very high compared with these guys. But it's still sampling. We do sampling in our brain, in our eye. Why don't we have to do this same process that I talked about? Well, actually we do. Your eye is a physical device. What it does when light comes into it, there's some element of blurring going on. That blurring is like a low-pass filter. So what you have in your eye is built together, a low-pass filter and the sampling devices put together. In a CCD camera, what you have is a little device which does the sampling, but those pixels, those samples, again, they're not perfect samples. They tend to blur a little bit around the edges. So you get the effect of the low pass being built into the sampling in those cases. It's important for what I'm going to talk about in just a second, or perhaps I'm going to talk about it next week. Here's another example of why this is important, where the sampling, there's an interplay between sampling and quantization. Remember, quantization introduced this noise. Sampling, the sampling rate is how quickly we sample, or the resolution we sample. So this is actually a picture of my son. And you notice this is a grayscale picture. This is an 8-bit picture. This is a 2-bit picture with the same resolution. Number of pixels is along the edges here. So this is a 2-bit picture. What's going on here? 2 bits, you can only represent, so this is a 1-bit picture. You can only represent zeros or one. So you have light or dark. Now you can clearly see that that's distorted the picture a lot. You can still tell what it is roughly, but you know, it's changed the picture a lot. There's a lot of quantization noise in there. But there are physical devices which can only output ones and zeros. And a classic example of this is a printer. Typical printers can either put a dot of ink on a page or no ink. They can't put a grey amount of ink. They can't put some level of ink on the page. There's either a bit of ink or there's no ink. How do you deal with that? Well, newspapers have dealt with this for many years. When they want to print an image, so incidentally, this is a picture of Peter Costello. I think this is the day that they abolished compulsory student unionism, and he looks like a very cheerful guy. This is a picture from, I think, The Australian, and you can see what they've done. This is the picture scanned at one resolution, and what I've done here is zoom in. I scanned it at a much higher resolution, and you can see that this picture is made up of a whole lot of little dots, and the size of the dots varies. Where I want black stuff, I have big dots that almost entirely fill the page. Where I want light bits, I have fairly small dots so that they don't fill the page very much. This is a standard way of what people call half-toning or dithering. Half-toning, I guess, in particular. It's a way of taking this one bit and turning it into something we can see. Why is this related to what I've been talking about? Well, we've got one bit quantization here, but the resolution is much higher. the size of these dots is really small. You see, you can't even see them on this particular picture. When you look at the newspaper, your eye is inherently doing this low-pass operation on it. So it's taking those bits, one bit here, one bit there, that resolution, and it's blurring it, and then resampling it. So what you're doing in the analog domain is you're taking this low number of bits, but high resolution, and you're converting it into a, still relatively high resolution, but not as high resolution, but more quantization bits, effectively. Essentially, the problem is that different sorts of technologies have different capabilities. And these are physical limitations. These are things that we can't overcome just by hoping they won't be so. Simple example is the various formats that we use to display things like images or movies. And, you know, the classic sort of example is you take something that's on film. Film is actually analog, so we can't really talk about its exact digital resolution, but I've given you a kind of rough idea of what the resolution might be for, say, 35mm film. And it's typically sampled in time at 24 hertz. That means we take 24 samples per second, 24 snapshots per second. Now, we run into immediate problems when we want to convert that to some other format, for instance, say, HDTV, which runs at 50 hertz. Now, one thing that you could do is you could simply double the rate. If you double the rate, it would be 48 hertz. That would be near 50 hertz. That sounds good, but it's not quite. Does it matter? Well, actually, what people tend to do is they do that. They double the rate, so when you look at your TV, typically what you're seeing if you watch a movie on TV is the same thing being displayed twice. You see the same snapshot twice, and then you see the next one twice, and so on, because your TV is running at double the speed of typical film. Do you see it? Well, personally, I don't notice it, so it's not a big deal. The other thing that happens is you get a slight overcranking effect, because instead of playing it at 48 hertz, you play it at 50 hertz. And again, people don't perceptually notice this when they're watching something like a movie. If you overcranked it a lot more, then people would start to look like they were moving really fast. But we don't have to worry too much about that, because we have only a 4% change. Not perceptually significant. Much bigger issue is changing resolutions when we have digital formats in one form or the other. So for instance, we might want to take typical PAL TV signal and display it on a high definition TV. Now, this is going to require some sort of resampling. Typically, people might in the video world call it interpolation, but it's a resampling of the signal. You notice also that the bit depth, the quantization, this is what we typically call quantization bits. In the video world, we call it the bit depth. So you notice that changes for the different formats, and actually there's often three signals here, RGB or one of the other different sorts of color coding systems would break the signal into three signals and give each of them some sort of bit depth. So you have these variable different sort of numbers of bits to encode things as well. Gets even more complicated when you consider something like a printer. Printer has a very high resolution, say 1200 dots per inch perhaps, but it only has one bit in terms of representing particular signals. So how can I take a photo, which you might not have this resolution, but it has color, it has 8 bits in each color, how do I represent that on a laser printer, which is not going to have that resolution? Well, actually, typically there's this trade-off between resolution and quantization. This is the sort of thing that you might, be forced to do if you didn't have that. You just simply put a threshold here. Anything darker than the threshold is made black. So you see all this dark region here becomes black, and the lighter foreground regions become white. So that would be the sort of naive way that you would go about producing a picture with one bit quantization. But notice this picture has the same resolution as this picture. We're going to exploit the fact that we can draw things at a higher resolution to to get past this limitation of one bit. Typically people call this line art. Don't quite know why it's called line art. It's not lines, but it is this sort of black and white picture. Newspapers have done this for many years, well before the digital signal processing revolution. What they do is they take their grayscale picture, something like this, and they turn it into a bunch of little dots. And the density of those dots determines the color we see. Why is that? Well, effectively what you do when you see the page is you smooth over the dots. You do a kind of low pass operation before you actually see those dots. When you look really closely, you can actually resolve the individual dots. So if you get a magnifying glass, take a magnifying glass home someday and have a look at some of the pictures in your newspaper and you will see they're made up of dots like this. So this is a kind of little example to give you an idea of what's going on here. Imagine we have some grayscale that we want to represent. We have some limited level of quantization, so this is four different colors, so that can be two bits. So here I have two bits that I want to represent. I'm going to approximate this by these different colors. So two bits I want to represent. How could I do that? Well, there's a couple of different ways. One would be to have dots. Obviously dots is what I'm talking about. Bigger dots correspond to darker colors. So if you take your eyes and you kind of blur them a bit, squint, then this bit will look dark like this. This will be a bit lighter, and this bit will be lighter, and this bit will be almost white. Obviously, these dots are really big. But if I have a very fine spatial resolution, I can make these dots as big or small as I like. So I can make them actually too small for us to individually see the dots, and what we see is the dots being blurred together to give us a color. Another thing I can do, instead of using these different size dots, because doing different size dots, you know, requires special sorts of, you know, technology to put, you know, a size dot on the page, I could use something like an inkjet printer, which produces very even but same size dots, and I could print different patterns. So I use a pattern like this to give you the darkest color, a pattern like that to give you the lightest color, and a pattern like this to give you, say, an intermediate color. And I just repeat that pattern over the whole image. So you can imagine this would be my pixel, and instead of printing one color per pixel, I'm printing four dots per pixel. So this is a direct exchange of spatial resolution. I've got twice the spatial resolution here, but the color resolution is being traded off. So the problem with these sort of techniques is they tend to look too regular. If I take a pattern like this and I repeat it over a whole image, I see that pattern because I see the effect of the pattern. It doesn't quite blur away the way you would like it to do. Our eyes are good at picking up patterns, even where we can't pick up the individual dots. So another way of doing this is to do what we call dithering. This is typically called half-toning. We have two tones, so we use half to get one color, half to get the other, and we do this sort of thing. Dithering is still a sort of half-toning technique, but what it does is it randomizes the way we do our dithering. So one classic way of doing this is to simply take our image, which I've indicated by I, X, Y. I is the value of the pixel at X, Y, and add a random value, and then I'm going to threshold that. In this case, I'm rounding it off to an integer. But if, imagine this value was between 0 and 1, and I add a value between 0 and 1, then the effect of rounding off would be to make some of the values 0 and some of the values 1. And that gives me my resulting image. So if I do that, I get things like this. So this, again, this is a picture of my son. I've taken it and I've just added this random noise and then threshold. So compare that picture to this one. This is where I just threshold. Here, I've added random noise before thresholding. And you can see that you get a much better idea of the grayscales. Now, in this picture, there's two things that are wrong with it. Firstly, there's a lot of speckliness in it. And that's because noise introduced this sort of speckly behavior. Okay, so that's not great. And one of the things we can do to reduce that is to use a cleverer way of dithering. And this is a cleverer way of dithering called Freud-Steinberg error diffusion. And what this does is it spreads that value of noise over several pixels. I'm not going to go into the exact algorithm here. Feel free to look it up at some point. It's not that complicated an algorithm, but what it does is it spreads that error, that noise, over a few pixels, which smooths it out. You can still see there's a lot of noise here. Part of the reason you can see that speckledness, though, is that I haven't done the exchange of resolution for quantization accuracy. What I've done is used the diffusion to get my quantization levels, but I haven't increased the resolution. And the reason for that is I have to display it on this monitor. I'm not printing this out on a printer. If I were going to print it out on a printer, I would increase the resolution of this image, and then I would perform dithering, and that dithered image, when I printed it, would then look much smoother, and the grays and everything would come out much more nicely. So that's what people would do in reality with this sort of problem. I have a little extreme example here. This is a thing called ASCII art. And what happens here is, ignore this, the big shape of this thing for a minute. What happens here is I've associated each pixel with a letter. And what I've done is I've chosen a letter which covers a lot of the area. This W is quite a dark letter when you think about it, to go with the dark colors. And I've chosen letters which don't cover much of that square at all, a dot in this case, for areas where it's lighter. Let's see how it comes out on the screen. I can see it when I look at the notes. Yeah, you can sort of see the picture through that. This is not a particularly good example because I didn't spend a huge amount of time trying to optimize it and make it look beautiful. But you can see that this sort of concept can be sort of generalized in a whole bunch of ways. So this is really just a nice little toy to show you, give you an idea of some of the scope of these sorts of ideas.